So this particular sutta, there's actually two suttas I'm going to do tonight, and both of them are very kind of foundational suttas, basic suttas. The first one is essentially about how to deal with, if you like, difficult people, difficult situations, how not to get upset, how to use your mind in a skillful way, not to get angry when there's a difficult situation around you. This is the first sutta. It's a very kind of classical, very fundamental kind of teaching of Buddhism. It's a kind of thing which is very useful in all situations of life. And the other sutta here is more of a kind of a sutta for monastics, if you like. It's more to do with lust and sensual desire, in particular in regard to the opposite gender. So the reasons I choose this kind of sutta is basically because these are the things which, if you practice these kind of things, will lead to happiness and well-being both in lay life and also in monastic life. And they are, if you get these things right, they lead to a sense of, you know, ease in life, whatever life you live basically. And they're very, very important for that particular reason. And you find that in the suttas, one of the things that Buddha stresses a lot in the suttas is this idea of harmony. And of course, this idea of harmony is very important, particularly in monastic life, when you live so close together in a monastery like this. You know, it's not that, it's a smallish monastery, but you get very close together when you live a monastic life, because you see each other all the time. And when you see each other all the time, you rub up against each other, and sometimes you get irritated, sometimes you get upset, even though they're the best people in the world, still you get upset with people. So it's important to actually strive for that sense of harmony and a sense of shared vision, a sense of going along the path in a nice way, looking upon each other as, with eyes, with friendly eyes, and blending together like milk and water, I think it says in some of the suttas. And that is the ideal for the monastic life. And of course, that is also an ideal that is good to strive for in lay life as well, because if you work like that together, it becomes very easy to live no matter what you do. And in fact, the Buddha said that if you want to have success in your meditation practice, success cannot come if there is disharmony and there is a sense of friction between people. Only harmony actually leads to success in meditation. And you see that there is a particular sutta in the Anguttara Threes. And this is a famous sequence of mental events that you see again and again in the suttas. It's often called the transcendental dependent origination. And this sequence basically starts off with, sometimes with faith, sometimes with virtue. And then there's a gradual movement from that faith and virtue to gladness, then to piti, which is rapture, which is one of these factors of meditation that we're supposed to experience, is a factor of jhana as well. And then to tranquility, to happiness, and then to samadhi. The stage-by-stage thing here. And that sequence can only start, it can only take off, if there is a sense of harmony here, and you're feeling a sense of communal ease. If that ease isn't there, that sequence doesn't even take off. So for this reason, it is a very important thing to work with. I'll start off this sutta. And I'll comment as I move along, and if you have any questions, please just raise your hand, and we can just do a discussion as we move along. This is the way I like to do it usually. So, okay, I think? Yeah. Okay, yeah. So we'll just do it that way. So this one, title of this sutta is called Removing Resentment. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. It is one of those Nikayas which doesn't really have a proper translation into English yet, but one of those translations will be coming out soon. Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, who you may have heard of, is actually working on the translation right now. And I've also been helping a little bit, so I've also been involved with this. And this is actually taken from that new translation. I got it on my memory stick when I came over here. So in about a year's time, the whole thing should hopefully come out. So it goes as follows. It's called Removing Resentment, Sutta 162 of the Anguttara Fives. There, the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus, friends bhikkhus. Friend, those bhikkhus replied, the Venerable Sariputta said this. Friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu, when it says bhikkhu here, we can read bhikkhuni, lay men, lay women, everybody's included in that, by which a bhikkhu should entirely remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What five? Here a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So the idea, this is a summary, if you like, of the sutta, and the sutta is often structured like this. The Buddha starts off, or Venerable Sariputta in this case, they start off with a summary, and then they go on to the actual sutta afterwards. It's a very good kind of what they call mnemonic device to help you memorize things, because you get the summary, and then the sutta, and sometimes the summary at the end again, to help you remembering these things. So the point here, of course, that these five categories of people, they basically encompass all people they possibly can be. So everything is included here. There's no person left out, from the purest person, number five here, to the least pure person, which was category number four. So everybody is included. So what this means, of course, is that there is no such thing as righteous anger or righteous resentment or righteous indignation. Because one should always strive to abandon these things, regardless of who this person is. So now the sutta moves on, and it goes through each of these five categories, starting with the first one. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a rag-road bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here you can see, this is one of those very standard ways that we talk in Buddhism about how to remove anger towards somebody. And that, of course, has all to do with how you focus on that person. It is the way you focus which actually makes the difference. And in just the same way as you have a cloth on the ground, you tear off the intact section and throw away the bad. In the same way, when you look at somebody, you focus on the part, the aspect of that person, which does not give rise to anger, does not give rise to negativity. And that is, of course, one of those foundational things. And I find it always very interesting, because you can read about these things in so many books. You know, you read about it here, read about it there, and it sounds right. But then when you actually see a sutta, when you see the Buddha or one of his senior disciples saying exactly the same thing, it lends those teaching a weight and a power which it doesn't have when you read it in a book by just about anybody else. So I always find it very powerful when I read something in the suttas that sort of just it adds weight to those teachings that you already are aware of and that you may be already using in your daily life to deal with these kind of things. So it's also important to remember here that the idea of being able to focus on somebody's good qualities and focus away from the bad qualities, it is not always easy to do. We may want to do that, but sometimes if the idea of somebody's badness or negative qualities become very entrenched in your mind, it's very hard to actually move away towards see the positive qualities. There's a number of things that you have to do to enable this to actually work. And the first thing is, if there is a particular person that you're having problems with, that you see the negative qualities in there, is to remind yourself. This is almost like a meditation practice. Remind yourself of the good qualities in that person. And build up that perception in your mind of the good qualities in this particular person. And then when you build up that perception inside of yourself, then when you have a problem with this person, it's possible to actually switch. If you get it in time, you can switch over and look at that person in a different light and different way. That becomes then very, very powerful. But again, you have to build it up. You have to build it up. You have to work with these things. And this is what in the sutta is often called the development of perception. The development of perception means that you are changing your outlook, essentially, of how people are, of how the world works. And then when the situation comes up, you can use it. And that is the first thing to do. The second thing, which is important here, of course, is that you have to catch it early on. The Buddha says in several suttas that once anger or desire takes hold in the mind, usually there's nothing much you can do about it except for just wait for it to calm down again. Because once it takes hold, it becomes like this force inside of you, which is very, very hard to turn around. So the more, and this is where, of course, mindfulness comes in. The mindfulness is a thing which enables you to catch these negative states at an early stage. So you have these two things. You have the mindfulness, which catches the state, and then you have developed a perception beforehand, which allows you to switch your attention from the negative to the positive. These two things together makes for a very powerful combination. And this idea of developing perceptions is actually a very important thing in the suttas. You will find that in the suttas, you find that, for example, the development of perception of impermanence, something you see all the time. And as I understand it, these are the kind of things which really is vipassana practice. Vipassana practice is the development and understanding of things, whether it's impermanence or non-self or suffering or whatever it is. And this is particularly in the Anguttara Nikaya, is something that you see in sutta after sutta after sutta, this development of the mind in perceptions. So this is very important, and this is also part of the practice that you actually see here in this sutta. You might ask, perhaps, why...
That's a very interesting simile. Considering the rag rather than picking the bits and pieces out of it that you want.
Right.
First of all, I'm wondering, is that where you got the pattern through? But it's interesting from a number of respects. But it strikes me as interesting culturally that if you, certainly if you're in Thailand, you'd never hold a rope down with your feet and stretch it out and tear it or something like that. But perhaps more importantly, but I think one other factor which is working there is that perception has to be based on a wisdom which actually understands what's the good bits of rope and what's not the good bits.
Right. Yeah.
And it has to come beforehand.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean pretending that there's no bad bits.
Right.
Yeah, which sometimes is what kind of positive thinking becomes. It's like a repression or almost automatic refusal to see bad things. You recognize that it's there, but you choose not to pay attention.
Right, yeah. I think it's a very, very important point, actually. And I was actually going to bring up something similar from the suttas as well. There is another couple of suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya which talk about perception as well. And they say, I think it's somebody asked, and it was like, Buddha, what's the difference between somebody who is moving forward on the path, somebody who can get enlightened, somebody who can't get enlightened? What is the difference? And so the Buddha says, well, the difference is that somebody who can get enlightened is somebody who understands that these perceptions lead to decline. And these are the kind of things that you're talking about now. If the perceptions are there, but you move away from them. These perceptions lead to stability. These ones lead to increase or to development. And these ones lead to penetration. Penetration meaning the four paths usually. And that is this difference between somebody who can attain enlightenment and somebody who can't. So it is just, all the perceptions are there, but you have to sort of filter your way through and find the ones that actually work. That's what it's all about. And he says, this is the whole sasana is that, basically, understanding which perceptions work and which don't. So, Okay. Anybody else want to ask? Please, please ask if you want to. Yeah. might be a big question. Sorry, yes? Please, sir.
And his family, everything. So there's an image. You know, at a certain point, you just hand away. See what I mean?
Mm.
That there's an image to try to see good in something. But at a certain stage, you realize it's too much.
So I think it goes together. You know, these are not two different things. They actually go together on the path. Because as you practice this goodness, you realize there comes a point when you don't want to be part of the world anymore. You want to move on. And it's not actually contradicted by your perception of what, you know, of people being good or things being good or anything like that. That is always a positive perception. It's actually the same kind of development. And as you become more pure inside, as you purify yourself, there comes a point when you naturally perhaps want to give up the world. I'm not saying that all monks and nuns necessarily give up the world for that reason. But that is one of the ways it can happen. That, you know, but through that development, you actually want to give things up. Because you see the limitations of that path as well. Okay. Just one more thing that I wanted to comment on this first one here. Because it's interesting the way it talks about bodily and verbal impurity here. And one might ask, well, does this mean that this is, you know, this is how you always have to work this, that you focus either on the bodily purity or the verbal purity or impurity for that matter here? And I think it's interesting that actually the Venerable Sariputta mentions these two aspects, because it might well be the case that these actually are important aspects, that, you know, somebody tends to be either maybe verbally impure or pure, or bodily pure or impure. In other words, these might actually be important categories to look at. But at the same time, I also think that this is just a standard way that Buddhism divides up, you know, how we act, how we are. It's either mind, body, or speech. So I think that actually what this means in the larger context is that anything, you can look at anything in a person as either pure or impure. Any kind of purity you can see in person. It doesn't have to be body or speech. It can be that they are generous, for example. That can be a beautiful aspect you can focus on. Or it can be that they have compassion or something, or they have some peace which comes later on. Anything you can find, basically, which is pure, that is where you can focus your attention. I don't think it necessarily strictly has to be the categories mentioned here. But you can think about that for yourself. You may come to a different conclusion because, you know, these are obviously open for interpretation, these things. So.
Well, bodily impurity doesn't mean, you know, you shower regularly.
Basically,
it's behavioural.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I was thinking that the notion of, whether pure and impure bodily behaviour or speech, it's very subjective to the individual's way of perception. I may think that this person is pure in bodily behavior according to my standard, but it may not be so. It is.
Well, you have to, I mean, this is. Well, one of the things that the Buddha always says is that, you know, if you're going to observe somebody else, you shouldn't make, like, rash judgments about somebody. You shouldn't say this person is bad, this person is good, from very little judgment. You should actually look for a long period of time. And after a long period of time, then you can make some judgment about that person. So this is obviously the first thing. You can also see that very often in community life, the people who come in like fresh and new, they're always given a chance. You very rarely get upset with somebody when they come in the first time, you know. It's very easy for me to come in for 5 days because you only know me for 5 days. So it makes it much easier. Usually it's after time. You've been together for a long time and you get to know people's habits and the way people are. That's when often irritations and problems start to arise, right? That's the way it is. So in exactly the same way, you have to observe somebody for a long time before you actually know their purity. The Buddha says specifically that to understand somebody's virtue, you have to observe them for a long time, you have to be wise, and you have to be attentive. So it's quite difficult, actually, to know somebody's virtue, wisdom, what else is there? Somebody's steadfastness or something like that. There's three or four things. So that is the thing. So you have to be very careful in your observation. You have to be wise yourself to be able to see these things. So that is what it's all about, really. But you will know, I mean, you know, there are certain people who are just very pure people, you know, and you know that. And generally people will agree on that that thing, generally speaking, yeah. Of course, there would be some adult, there are some who don't have that kind of, you know, eye of the wisdom, if you like, from a Buddhist point of view. Yeah. But generally speaking, you know, as a Buddhist, you will have some agreement on who is pure and who isn't pure, yeah. I think, yeah. That's my experience anyway, yeah. If you come to my monastery, if you come to Bodhinyana monastery where I stay here, most people agree that Ajahn Brahm is the purest monk in the Sangha, for example. That's one example there. Yeah. Okay. So let us move on. So that was the first one. The second one is very similar here. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose that a pond covered with algae and water plants, a man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So this is essentially the same as the last one. The simile here is a bit different, but the simile conveys essentially the same message. And this is the idea that you sweep away the defilement, you sweep away the negative things. You don't focus there, you put those away. And then, once you have swept those away, then the good characteristics come to the fore. This is what happens in this case. And you see the good parts, and you focus on those instead. Any thoughts on that simile about it? Of sweeping away the algae and whatever? Yeah.
I think for me what comes up so much is the context, or the skill of skillful means, you know, what skillful means actually means. You said before, you know, developing the skillful means of knowing which perceptions work and which don't.
Right.
Which, you know, places further trouble and which maybe, you know, need to liberate you.
Yeah.
And, having that art, that skill of being able to see a person and, you know, their skillful qualities, not so skillful, but using your mind skillfully to direct towards more focusing on what is working for that person, what they are doing well, and just the concept of skillful.
That's a very good point. It's two things. The skillful means is one thing. But it's also like the faith and confidence that it's worthwhile and it's important to do. Those things go together. So you have the means. But to be able to acquire the means, you have to understand the importance of this whole issue. And that's where the bigger kind of picture of Dhamma comes into play. You know, you really want to, the more understanding you have the Dhamma as a big kind of picture, that about all these things about rebirth come into this. And when you see that big picture, you understand the importance of actually getting in there and actually doing this as well. And then you apply the skillful means with more kind of more precision and more understanding, perhaps, when you do that.
I see you a person who fits into that category, and I tell other people, you know, she's actually a nice person if you ignore everything which comes out of her mouth. It was true. She was a nice person. The speech was pretty harsh.
Right. Yeah, so that's good. That fits very well with what he's saying here, actually. Yeah. So. That's a good one, yeah. Okay, so that was the second category. Go over to the third one now. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle, then a person might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, this little bit of water is in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, or make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and depart. He then gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, But from time to time, he gains an opening of the mind, a placidity of the mind. On that occasion, one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of the mind he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment toward that person should be removed. So, this here is a case of somebody who is obviously has a fair number of bad qualities. Both his bodily behavior is not so good and his speech is not so good. But occasionally he gets what is said here, an opening of the mind. Now, this word opening of the mind, the opening here is vivarana. And vivarana is essentially the opposite of nivarana. And nivarana is the Pali word for hindrance, right? The five hindrances. So what we are seeing here is basically the opposite of the five hindrances. So this opening of the mind means like an unobstructed mind, unobstructed by the hindrances, essentially. That's what it means. And this other word, placidity, which Bhikkhu Bodhi uses here, this is the word for pasada. And pasada is this Pali word which has very many different connotations depending on the context. It means like that you have a calm mind, a peaceful mind. Placidity means like something which doesn't have any ripples, right? It's placid. It also means like a confident mind. So these two factors go together. When you don't have any hindrances, you feel confident, you feel at peace, you feel at ease. There is no kind of agitation there, which is the opposite, I think, of placidity. So essentially what this is saying here is that this person, although he may not be very virtuous, occasionally he gets some good meditation, some samadhi perhaps, some mindfulness, and he has some positive mental states at the very least. And you might wonder, well, how can you know that somebody has a positive mental state? And of course, the reality is that very often we can know just by watching somebody. If you look at somebody, you can usually tell whether they are peaceful or they're agitated. If you look carefully, particularly over a long period of time, you can know somebody's character reasonably well. So this is the thing here, is that by observance, you can actually see these kind of things. In fact, in the suttas, the Buddha talks about three different ways of reading somebody's mind. And usually we think about reading mind as just like you read somebody's mind directly. But the first way is actually just watching somebody. And by watching somebody and seeing how they act and how they behave, if you are sharp enough, according to the Buddha, you can straight away tell what state of mind they're in there. That's pretty, pretty good. So this is a similar thing, I think, that we have here. You can actually tell somebody's mental state simply by observing them. But of course, when somebody does have that many problematic personal qualities, you have to be very careful how you focus. You have to be able to focus in a very narrow field. And this is, of course, the meaning of the simile here. If you don't focus very narrowly, if you move a little bit to one side, maybe focus a little bit too far to one side, then it's like stirring up the water in that little puddle, because you start seeing the negative qualities rather than focusing on the narrowness of the good qualities. That makes sense to everybody? Yeah. Everybody happy with that? Yeah?
I think that one can also be good for conflict and jealousy. That's like a bad concept, but they get good meditation. It's easy. Some people like that. It's easy. Yeah. You're basically a bit jealous.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I don't think you have to be jealous, because usually if somebody is like that, they usually means they're going downhill. So they might still, fortunately, still, you know, still have some good karma there.
It's not the other way. They've just come from that background, and now they've kind of started karma and good meditation, but they still have a lot of their old habits.
Yeah, well, usually the reason why you have good meditation is because you have some good karma from the past, right? So somebody who is a bad person, if they have been bad in this life, they must have done something good in the past life, otherwise it wouldn't happen. So there is, sometimes it's a movement in the wrong direction. So that is actually a potential cause for compassion there. Okay, but now we get to the really scallywag person, the next one here. So this is number four. So how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, from time to time? Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along the highway, and the last village behind him and the next village ahead of him were both far away. He would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant. he would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another man travelling along the highway might see him and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this man obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May he get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this man does not encounter misery and calamity right here." So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for him, thinking, "Oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May he abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May he abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body, after death, he will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in the bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed." So this is this technique here is very, very useful, because obviously sometimes it might be difficult to find the good point in somebody, but it's always possible to have compassion. And this kind of depersonalizes the whole idea of somebody behaving badly. Very often we feel upset because somebody is behaving towards us in a way which we feel is unfair or wrong or bad or whatever. But by instead focusing on the fact that this person actually is creating suffering for themselves, in this way we can turn around and we can instead focus on that suffering in their own life in the future. And then compassion can arise instead of anger or negativity towards that person. But this is very, very, very useful. And one of the things that I sometimes think of in my own life is I often reflect, if somebody does something which I feel is unreasonable or unfair towards me, I often reflect that this is in fact not a personal thing. Very often the reason why we get angry with somebody is because we feel it's personal. We feel this person is doing something to me. It's something between two people, something between two selves, two substantial entities. But in actual fact, nobody ever does anything towards you. It's never personal. It's never between two people. The reason why somebody does something bad or unfortunate or whatever, or something which is not very pleasant towards you, is because of the cause and conditions in their own life. That's why it happens. So perhaps you have a particular quality that this person doesn't like, so treat you in a bad way. Now, if you weren't there, but somebody else was there who had exactly the same qualities as you, they would treat that person exactly the same way. It's not personal. It's because of reactions to circumstances and situations. And this is very powerful, because it takes the personality, the kind of sense of there being an ego or self, or somebody actually being on bad terms with each other. It takes the whole personal thing out of it and makes it just a reaction to conditions. And I know that one of the nice stories, and I don't know if many of you have read Ajahn Brahm's book, Opening Door of Your Heart, but many people read this book, and it's a very nice book of stories. Now, one of the stories in this book is about this man, it's like a businessman or something, he's in a big hurry, so he jumps into his car, he's going off to a meeting somewhere, and just as he gets into his car, he gets around the corner, there is suddenly there's a red light there, and he gets really upset, and he starts yelling at this light, saying, "Oh, you terrible light, you knew that I was in a hurry, I need to get to this meeting in time." And he gets out of his car and shakes this red light because he's so upset. Now, that, of course, is madness, and we all agree that is madness, because a red light is something which has like an electronic circuit. And when that circuit says go red, it goes red. When the circuit says go green, it goes green. The light doesn't have an intention. But of course, the point is that human beings are just like red lights. We go red we go red when certain conditions are ripe. We go green when certain conditions are ripe. And that's all there is to it. There's nothing personal there. And when you think of it like that, it takes away so much of that problem, which is like an interpersonal problem. That is where some of the worst kinds of anger and negativity can arise. So that is, that is one way I sometimes try to think. And I think this is also part of what might be implied by this particular method here.
Dante,
yes.
I was thinking about an example like domestic violence, or where, you know, it's bad behaviour and bad speech.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly you can be compassionate towards the perpetrator, the person that's doing it, and understand that they're in a terrible space, they're not happy.
Sure.
But isn't it also compassion to oneself to remove oneself? Is that...
Yeah. But that's a very important point, I think, yeah. And I think if you are in a very difficult situation, there's nothing wrong with getting yourself out of that situation, you know. If you are in a situation with domestic violence, then for goodness sake, leave, you know, and go somewhere else. And you, I mean, obviously you don't leave straight away, but if you have tried enough and you know it's not going to work, then leave and go somewhere else. I think that's a very important principle in life. Don't sort of allow yourself to be abused. That's not something of the Buddhist path either. The Buddhist path is certainly to have compassion towards yourself and know what is right and wrong. And I think the same thing often goes with work as well. Many people have problems at work, for example. Can be very difficult. And if it gets too difficult, then, you know, it's nothing wrong with, you know, quitting your job and going somewhere else or doing something else. It's perfectly acceptable. It's actually, I would say, it's wiser. And as you say, it's looking after yourself. And as you know, the Buddha always said that the first person that you should really have kindness towards is yourself. You know, that's the first person. And it makes good sense, because you can always do, you know, you can do something for yourself. Whether you can help somebody else is always uncertain, but you know, you're closest to yourself. You can do something for yourself. Yeah, it's a good point.
In that situation, also by removing yourself, there's also compassionate for the other person, because you're stopping them from being creating bad karma.
Mm.
And so, in a sense, you're doing what you can to protect them as well.
Mm. It might make them think about the situation as well. If you go away, they might actually think differently. You know, if you're always there, they might just continue old habit, which is always just keep going. Yeah, that's true.
And that translation is a work in progress, and it's going to be published very soon.
Yeah.
Has much been changed, or, you know, with that language? What struck me was, the compassion part is really elaborated and made much of, and sometimes what happens in some of the other sutras I've read, certainly metta is elaborated, but sometimes with the compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity, sometimes it's just sort of, you know, it's been, you know, verbalized in the metta part, that you just assume that you follow through with the compassion. That compassion is really being opened up, and it's really beautiful. And
right.
I'm just wondering if it has been done that way.
I think I was actually going to talk a bit about compassion and metta and sort of, you know, how they actually how they work in this particular sutta. And I think it is fair to say that in the suttas, metta is probably more important than compassion. And I think the reason, I think, you know, you could argue here, for example, that instead of the first two categories of people, the first three categories of people, instead of having metta towards them, instead of focusing on the good aspect, you could also focus on the bad aspect and have compassion, and saying, well, you're creating bad karma for yourself, you're going to suffer in the future. So why is it that Ramsa Buddha says we'll focus on the good ones? And I think that compassion is, in many ways, a higher kind of practice than metta. Because compassion can very easily lead to a sense of pain inside of yourself. If you see a lot of suffering around you, a lot of problems, a lot of people doing bad things, you focus on that all the time, and you focus it slightly off, you might feel sad about it, or maybe even depressed, you know. But unbalanced, exactly. But if you focus on the good qualities, it's always going to lead to a sense of happiness for yourself. So I think metta is actually the simpler practice and the more easy one, and the one we should probably start with. And for that reason, I think this is the way it is presented here in this particular sutta. Yeah. And it's also, the other thing is that you find that in the suttas, one of the basic principles of all the, you know, Buddhist teachings is that it's gradual. It's like incremental. It goes from the lower levels and goes upwards always. And the Buddha actually says that if you teach the Dhamma, one of the things you should always think about when you teach Dhamma is that it should be a gradual discourse, incremental, progressive, if you like. So because of that, and you know that the way the four Brahma Viharas are explained in the suttas, these divine abidings, metta is always first, then comes compassion, then comes mudita, which is often translated as sympathetic joy, then comes equanimity, upekkha. And that gives you an idea of also the natural way of developing these things. Metta comes first, it's the most easy one, and then equanimity is actually the highest one, the most difficult one. So that is gives you some idea what's happening there. And also, if you generally speak and in the suttas, you find that there is much more emphasis on metta generally. General metta is often described in much greater detail than the other actually here. Yeah. Brahma Viharas here. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah. You mean this kind of idea?
Yeah.
Yeah. To have a sense of compassion on yourself, you mean, and not be too hard on yourself and this kind of thing.
Or just instead of beating yourself over the head about losing your temper yet again, you can sort of contemplate the good things.
Yeah.
And, do you think that?
Of course, it's very, very important. It's central to the Buddhist teachings. No, I fully agree with you. This is about, what they talk about Silanusati and Chaganusati, this contemplation of your virtue and contemplation of your generosity. These are kind of foundational meditation practices in the suttas. No, I very much agree with you. And we were actually talking about this yesterday at tea time as well, that sometimes people put the bar very high. They have very, very high expectations of themselves. I should never get angry. I should never, say anything wrong and all these things. And very often it becomes like almost like self-oppressive in a sense. You oppress yourself because you have expectations that are too high. And you forget to look at the good sides of yourself. That is actually very important. I remember one of the other things which... I always tend to refer a lot to Ajahn Brahm because I've been living with him for so long. Yeah. But one of the things that he always says is that, he was the builder of basically of Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth. And as a builder, you tend to look at faults all the time. We look at, what can be improved, where should the next building go up, and what should I do? And this is a bit like seeing faults in yourself, a similar kind of thing. Yeah. So he said, he decided that after many years of doing this, what I need to do, he said, is I need to just go around the monastery and look at all the things I had done. And he would deliberately go around and look at all the buildings that had been built and all the things that had happened over the last, 25 years or whatever. And that leads to the opposite. That leads to contentment, to happiness, a sense of peace, instead of fault-finding and always, blaming yourself or whatever. Yeah. I think that's a very important point. I think it's people tend to be too hard on themselves. And because the idea that this is a gradual path, a gradual training here, and it takes a long time to change your habits, habits of speech, habits of mind, whatever. You should look, if you see that there is change over the months and over the years, well, then you know that you're going the right direction because the change is happening over a long period of time. Don't get upset because you get angry today because that is your kind of your habit. Rather look at the change that happens over a long period of time. And then when you see that there is improvement there, then you can feel a sense of happiness. This is one of the reasons I'm still a monk, I think, because I see improvement. If you saw what I was like when I first became a monk, you might be shocked. But it actually is. You can see the change, and that is one of the wonderful things about this path. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
In regards to seeing faults in other people's behaviour and stuff, it's good to see or contemplate their good qualities. But at what point should you, especially when you need to have compassion, when do you actually, maybe there's a skillful means in actually telling a person that what they're doing is not skillful and it would lead to their own suffering, or should you, this sister talks about contemplating the good side and trying to not look so much at the bad side, should you actually, for them to actually improve, or whatever?
Sure,
is there a need for any action?
Generally speaking, it's very difficult to change other people, you might think you have compassion with them, but sometimes you just come from the center, I wish they were different because it's bothering me or whatever, So it is very difficult, and I don't know. I think people have to be ready, and when people are ready, things usually happen. Maybe they will ask you, or they will want to go to go to a talk or something like that and actually learn something about these things. But usually people have to be ready. When they're ready, then you can tell them. So you have, if you're very perceptive and you can see that the person is ready, you might say something. But if you have doubts that they're ready, then very often it can very often be counterproductive because they get defensive and they get negative and they don't want to hear what you're saying here. So you have to be very, very careful with actually trying to correct anybody else. And this is why the Buddha's teaching is about focusing on yourself, basically. Change yourself. And then very often you find that other people become interested. If they see that you are improving, you are changing in your life, then they also take notice of that and they start to change. One of the interesting things that happened to me is that when I first became a monk, my family, my parents were sort of, what on earth are you doing? You know, this madness, you know, some kind of going into some kind of sect and you know, they had no idea about Buddhism basically. Yeah. But now, after 15 years as a monk, they tell me they're interested in Buddhism. They ask me, well, give us a talk about Buddhism. I recently went with them to, they came to Australia. I went with them around a few places. And my father said, well, you know, it's like you're my teacher now, he said to me. And I thought, wow, what's going on here? And that is very, very nice. And this is what happens when they see that, you know, you're doing something good. And it has a kind of positive effect on you. You have been doing it for a long time. It's not some kind of, you know, idea you have and you sort of quit straight away. Then people around start to take notice. And that is when change can actually happen. I think it's very important not to, you know, and it is basically a practice for yourself, the Buddhist practice, because you can change yourself. You have control of yourself to a certain extent. Even that is difficult enough to change yourself. Changing others is that much, much harder than changing yourself. Yes?
Did Sutta say anything about the usefulness of sharing with someone else what's going on for you? Like, when that happened, you know, I was really sad or you know, what was going on for me when a person did something?
Good question. I think about that.
Yes, there's quite a lot of service talks about the qualities of a good friend, someone that you can share things with and you don't have any secrets from and so on.
Yeah.
And somebody will listen to you when times are bad and these kinds of things.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. I can also think of some perhaps in the vinaya where it's either like a monk should reveal his faults to his companions in a holy life. So that's the idea. It's something you feel uncomfortable with it yourself, you should reveal it, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that is very powerful. You know, if you are practicing well and you ask somebody for forgiveness, for example, if you do something wrong yourself, that is very, very powerful. People get really taken aback from that. So, I mean, don't do it too much because then it looks strange, but, you know, occasionally it's a good thing. So, yeah, indeed. Yes?
Baba, I have two questions. First of all, you mentioned the five hindrances. What are they and what does that mean?
Okay, well, the five hindrances are like the Buddha's kind of main framework for how to deal with the mind in meditation. So they are basically the sensual desire, which is desire for anything through the five senses. Then there is ill will. Then there is sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry. And the final one is doubt. This is kind of, it's a summary the Buddha uses to say, this is the stuff that you have to overcome to be able to go into deep meditation, basically. And one way of looking at the Buddhist path is like a gradual overcoming of the five hindrances, all the way up till they're completely gone.
Is that with kind of anything you do, not just Buddhist practice, is that with anything you
see? It's very, very useful to overcome the five hindrances in anything in life because, you know, if you're angry or you have a lot of sloth and torpor or restlessness or whatever, you can't focus on anything, can't do anything well, you know. If you want to do anything well in life, overcome the hindrances is extremely useful. In the suttas, there is a sutta where a Brahmin goes to the Buddha and says, oh, you know, sometimes I can remember all these, you know, the Brahmins have all these hymns and things that they chant and this kind of things. And it says to the Buddha, oh, sometimes I can remember this and sometimes I can't. What is the reason? One case you have the five hindrances, another case you don't. That's the reason why you can and you can't.
Also, I don't really understand this separation between impurity, because with the body and the mind, like, wouldn't it be hard to have bodily impurity if you don't have an impure mind? you sort of feel what I mean?
It would be hard to have bodily impurity if your mind is not impure. Huh?
Yes.
Is that what he meant?
Yes.
Yeah, I think the point here is that, you know, he says that from time to time we get the purity of the mind. It's not that all the time. Of course, if you have a pure mind, your bodily is automatically going to be pure. Yeah. So it just means that occasionally you sort of get out of your kind of your habits and you sort of, yeah. That's the point there, I think. Yeah.
I think it's also talking to some on a matter of general behaviour is what we can observe as someone's body in speech.
Mm.
And you can't do it, see how the psychic powers or whatever, you can't directly observe their mind, so you can only infer from it.
Yeah.
From that kind of level, that's what you're presenting.
Hmm. Okay. So let we come now to the fifth person. This is the most inspiring person. Yeah. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean, with smooth banks, a delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, he would bathe and drink, and then, after coming out, he would sit or lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind, the placidity of the mind, that he gains from time to time. In this way, resentments toward that person should be removed. Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence. So here, of course, the point here is that you don't really need to push anything aside. You don't need to sort of push away the algae and the water plants, so you don't need to cut off the bad parts of the rope, because everything is beautiful about this person. So wherever you look at this person, you're going to see something which is nice. And that, of course, is the great thing about a person like that. And because whenever you look at them, you always see something, you tend to get inspired by them. And this is why it says here that by means of this kind of person, it inspires confidence in every way, and you gain confidence of mind. And this is one of the things that you see again and again in the suttas as well, that confidence arises always with regard to somebody who is pure-hearted, somebody who doesn't have any greed or hatred or delusion. That's where confidence arises, and that is where naturally you are inclined. I think both because you realize the beauty of the conduct, and also, like Blake was saying the other day, that you also want to get there. You also want this kind of state. You realize this is a beautiful thing. Somebody who acts like that must have a very beautiful mind, you realize that. And because you have that inclination towards that, it becomes very inspiring, a very beautiful example for yourself. Yes, sir. this is an interesting point. And I think this is the point here is that, and this is the nice thing in that people who are very spiritually developed, they often are like mirrors to yourself, you know, because you realize on the one hand that they're very pure, and still sometimes you get upset with these people. And then after a while you realize that the reason you get upset has got nothing to do with that person. It has got to do with you, your own defilements. And in this sense, they become like a mirror. And this is like for somebody who was enlightened or very close to enlightenment or very pure because of samadhi or whatever, they tend to reflect back on you. And you're actually forced to look at yourself and to see that the problem is here with you and not with the other person. And this is the thing about life, you know, regardless of how pure you are, even if you're fully enlightened, even if you're the Buddha, you still get blamed sometimes, you still get problems, you still people get angry at you. And this is never going to stop just because you're pure. It happens much less, but still, the problem is still there. So, simply because we see problems where, in fact, there aren't anything here.
Or is looking through, you know, a your own delusion or what they're seeing really has nothing to do with the person. So if actually the person really sees that person,
right, that's the thing, you aren't like to see that person precisely,
That must also be the case for all the other four people.
Precisely,
So what you see really through the lens of your own.
Indeed, Quite right. So basically, that is what you learn about yourself in that sort of situation. You actually realize that, there is a problem not just with the other person. The problem is with me as well. Then, so yeah.
That reminds me of a Martin Brown made about dealing with difficult people a couple of years ago. It's just very, very skillful. He talked about all this, and then he came back to actually dealing with yourself.
Right. The difficult person, the most difficult one is yourself, right? Yeah, that's good. Okay, so. Oh, sorry, yes?
So, is this one essentially jealousy?
Not necessarily. It's just that, you have your own defilements, and sometimes you get angry because of stupid things, people do something that you don't like, which you feel is inconvenient for you, and maybe actually not fault of them theirs at all. It's just that you're making a problem out of something which actually isn't a problem. How things can be sometimes, I'm sure. Yeah. And and that is why, I don't think they were jealous. I don't think so. I don't think that's the point here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think jealousy could be jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that happens. So I think the other thing is that when someone is a very pure kind of spiritual person, is that they almost like invite a kind of an excessive or an overload of projections and expectations that people put on them. So it's actually, that's how we normally relate to people anyway. We project a fragment of ourselves onto them, and we recognize a part of ourselves in them, and that gives us a connection with them. So if somebody who's very spiritually pure, that's always happens to an extreme degree. And because they're pure, then almost like the negative fragments that we're projecting on them become almost highlighted. They're kind of vivid contrast with the reality of their actual behaviours. It becomes even more frustrating.
Yeah.
It's like if you see some dirt on a very clean surface or something like that, it's even more obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also that our ideas of spiritual perfection and so on, for those of us who are still beginners in the spiritual path, they're often very confused.
Mm-hmm.
And they're often tied up with, they have like a genuine aspect of spiritual, a genuine spiritual understanding is there, but it's also mixed up with a whole lot of other things like residue about projections on our parents or on our teachers and all of these kinds of things, which is kind of half digested sitting there in our mind somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tend to, this is a mechanism they use in psychology, they call it transference and counter-transference, that we tend to project on someone who's a teacher, we project onto them all of our problems to an even greater degree.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually quite important to understand both for the student in relating to a teacher, but especially for the teacher in relating to the students, is to understand that people will do that.
Mm.
To quite an intense degree, and so don't get too worried about it.
Yeah.
I have a good example of this sort of person. I mean, there's a sort of case, and I listened to Ajahn Brahm's Dharma talks 2 years ago, several years.
Mm.
Quite important to see that. And then I met Ajahn Brahm for the first time in person.
Mm.
And my son goes, gee, actually, Ajahn Brahm's pretty fat. And he's like, wow. And he just look at my like, wow, how did it do that? It's very easy to dispel that because it's full of Ajahn Brahm's positive qualities. The mind can easily get into that sort of thinking, even around this pure person, over my striking things.
Yeah. Well, that's true, actually. Oh, dear. Yeah.
Well, with regard to what I think,
about the Genesis part. I'm not talking about the Genesis that is not the Genesis that you were trying to explain. Is it the Genesis that you confused because of the comparison of his or her own default life to that same person? So
can be.
Is that Genesis actually jealous? Because, like, for instance, I look at Bhante as a pure person and I feel jealous and I have that resentment there, thinking that, you know, because of him I'm made to look so impure or something like that. Is that it?
Can be, yeah. I think it happens sometimes. Yeah.
Hmm.
Bhante? Is there such a person? I mean, even if you're enlightened, is there someone that's pure in, you know, body and speech and but even thinking of, like, some of the Buddha's suttas, he seems annoyed at times, or, you know, with silly questions or whatever. So I'm wondering, is it more that, you know, if the Buddha or, you know, someone who's enlightened, more that they have an awareness of their behaviour and their actions and when they're annoyed, versus that they are always pure and they never get annoyed and they never get
Supposedly you can get completely pure, yes. That's supposedly from, like, according to the Sutra, that's what you can, yeah. You can purify yourself to the point where you don't get annoyed at all, even for the most, you know, silly and stupid question. But the point is that, you know, the Buddha may see, you know, sometimes you have to distinguish between actual annoyance and apparent annoyance. And the Buddha has many different ways of answering a question. If he thinks the question is stupid, he may not even answer it.
Yeah.
Because you may realize that this is the best way of actually answering if I'm not answering, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So it is, sometimes it's just a matter of, again, you know, skillful means or whatever, what is the right way of approaching this.
Right.
But according to the suttas, yes, you're supposed to be able to get to a point where you have no, absolutely no anger, no irritation, no annoyance, no desire for the, you know, for the sensory world around you. So, yeah, very, very pure. Yeah. That's what it says. Yeah.
The interesting other thing on that is that it's be very cautious about those kinds of inferences from the suttas, because it's very difficult to infer, even if you're talking to somebody, it's very difficult to infer their actual motivation or what's behind it. You know them very well. And when you're talking about somebody 2,500 years ago, and what you have is a couple of words in a sutta, which, you know, can be translated in different ways, and which in another version of the sutta may be presented slightly differently or very differently, then you have to be very cautious. That's why one of the basic principles that we always use when we're interpreting suttas is to distinguish between the explicit statements and the inferred statements. And so, you know, you have to really, it's only fair to the Buddha, if you've been sympathetic to the Buddha and how he expressed something himself, it's fair to him to assume that if he stated something very definitively and clearly and explicitly, it's because that's how he wanted it to be understood. And if he said that again and again and again during his life, that one can get rid of completely of grief, hatred and delusion, which said hundreds and hundreds of times in the suttas, then it's only fair to him to think that he really meant that straightforwardly and that's what he actually did. And if we see one or two passages where he calls Devadatta a god of spit, and we think, well, if I was going to call someone a god of spit, I'd probably have to be pretty angry before doing it. But, you know, it's very difficult. You know, you can't sort of change your understanding of the overall main straightforward teachings that the Buddha taught again and again, because of an inference which is derived from a passage appears in one place or another.
Yeah. This is the thing about the suttas. When you read the suttas, you realize that there are certain things which are very kind of central to the suttas, and which, as Bhante says, it occurs again and again and again in the suttas. And this is like the main message. And sometimes you have like strange statements which are coming from left field, and you don't know where they're coming from. Maybe it was never said by the Buddha. If it only occurs once or twice, maybe it comes from somewhere else. It may have infiltrated from, you know, from some other way. So because of that, it's a kind of a basic kind of way of interpreting the suttas. Never use the kind of individual strange statements to interpret the important ones. It's to be the other way around. They use the kind of the central message to interpret the strange ones and the funny ones. And I think that is a very, very, very important thing. Yeah. So,
which is a bit like tearing off a bit of bad carpet.
When it comes to speaking about pure speech, I just wonder sometimes whether being honest and direct is considered pure speech, or going beating about a bush and having flowery language is a pure speech. One is something that is truthful and trying to help another person.
Yeah.
Another one is just trying to be indirectly giving a hint, but not exactly saying the same.
Well, I mean, all of these things depend on the situation, the circumstance. You know, you cannot really say, it isn't like a kind of golden rule, this is always right, this is always wrong here. But the most important thing there is always to look at your motivation as well, you know, because everything in Buddhism is motivation-based, intention-based. If your motivation is pure, then you're probably doing the right thing anyway, because you're coming from a good place. But sometimes you can say, oh, you know, I'm going to tell them directly, and you can say it is right speech, but actually you're coming from a sense of annoyance, instead of actually being from a pure place. So check your motivation, that's the most important thing. And if your motivation is good, chances are that what you're going to say is just about right. But the second thing you can check is also, of course, the suitability. Is it suitable? Is this person in the right mood? Is it the right, are they ready? Are they open? Are they busy right now? Is it the right time? Are they defensive? You know, all of these things come, it's like your sensitivity to the situation is also important. So once you have checked that your motivation is pure, if you have the kind of the resources, you can also check, you know, be sensitive to the situation as well. And those two things come together. And then you decide whether it's right to sort of say things straight or, you know, beat a bit around the bush maybe in this particular circumstance or whatever. Yeah. So.
I still remember one Chinese spiritual
guru
mentioning something like that to many of us. You know, he always sets the example that, you know, sometimes you just cannot trust the person when they say, is it alright to tell me what is wrong with me? Because there are many people, like many friends who come and say, please tell me when I'm doing something wrong, or, you know, I'll definitely listen to you and I'll change. But when it's actually time to tell them that you have done things which is not very good, and that could be the end of your friendship. So you can't tell when the right time is.
Right, yeah. That's true. I agree with you. You can't take such statements because it depends on the circumstances, whether they're open or ready for these kind of things as well. Yeah, it's very true. Yeah. But I think as a general rule, this is one of the nice things about Buddhism, is that it all comes back to intention and motivation very much, you know. And once you look at intention and motivation, that is actually much more important than having very clear guidelines about anything almost, whether it's speech or action or whatever. That's what it always comes back to. And then you can start, once you look at it that way, you can start to tackle very complex questions, you know, society questions, like things like euthanasia and abortion and human rights and all these kind of things, which are very complex things. You can tackle them because you have a deeper understanding of where the real problem lies. Okay. Are you ready? Sorry. go for it. Yeah.
When you're dealing with these, you know, like difficult people, like say someone treating you badly or, you know, just disrespecting you in some way, and you react with a kind of defensiveness to it, you know, like you feel this need to defend yourself.
Yeah.
And it seems to come from this place of, you know, insecurity or feeling like, you know, yeah, you're sort of downtrodden, you need to stand up for yourself.
Hmm.
But at the same time, sometimes, you know, maybe you're expecting too much from other people, like expecting respect from everyone is a sort of conceited thing, you know, that maybe I think too highly of myself.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like on the one hand, I feel really inferior, but then on the other hand, maybe I think too much of myself, and I'm really struggling to see which one it is, you know.
I think that is the kind of the delusion that you think you're going to get respect from everybody around you, because you're not. That's never going to happen. The world isn't like that. There's always going to be some people who are going to treat you badly. That's the way it is. And that is just facing up to reality, basically. That is a very important aspect of the Eightfold Path. This is part of understanding suffering. The world is like this. You're not going to be able to change it. You're not going to have respect from everybody. It's never going to happen. You're always going to hear bad things. And this is one of the things that sort of helps you in the practice. Because you understand that, you know, I cannot change this. I'm always going to suffer to a certain extent. And that sort of, you know, that's a very good spur in the practice. But the other thing is that, you know, when in a situation like that, when somebody does treat you badly, and you become defensive or whatever, again, it's a matter of not having too high expectations of yourself. It is okay to defend yourself, you know, as long as you do it in a reasonable way. You don't, you know, get nasty or bad or whatever, you know. it's acceptable to defend yourself. And even in monastic life, sometimes you have to defend yourself, you know. I mean, one example is in a monastery in Perth. We had this actually a legal case against a company who was carting clay past the monastery here. And we went on for years because it was a very noisy operation going past the monastery here. And that was a kind of a defense. And, you know, we had a lawyer who was a Buddhist lawyer who helped us with this whole case. So it is acceptable to defend yourself. But, of course, you try to do it in a nice way. And you try to develop yourself along the route so that next time you fall into the same situation, somebody is disrespectful towards you, you actually are even better at dealing with the situation. And in this way, you're gradually kind of moving up, you know, at this inclination, and you become better. So don't expect too much of yourself, because you're just going to cause suffering for yourself if you do that. Does that answer your question, or
yeah? Well, I guess the hard part is that, yeah, it's just how you do it. Like, it's so hard. Like, how do you defend yourself? Because it's so hard not to get overly aggressive sometimes. You know, at the same time, you don't want to let yourself get, you know, treated badly.
You want to be, like, shot by someone by showing them compassion.
Yeah, exactly. If you're nice to someone who treats you badly,
if you're compassionate to someone who's doing something wrong, then it feels like you're kind of giving
it. Yeah, like, they can get away with getting badly.
Yeah, but sometimes you can just, you know, I mean, you have to do something else then, instead of actually treating them nice, you just go walk away or try to avoid them or you know, or instead of actually becoming aggressive, try some other tactic instead. It doesn't mean that you have to sort of be very nice towards them.
It
makes life more difficult.
Well, sometimes, I don't know, like, I've tried that a lot, just walking away from people, and now that's become a pattern in my life where that's all I have to do is walk away from it, and that's become destructive as well, you know.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the things is that if you actually are able to have compassion for the person right there and then, you can actually react in a positive way, because you are cool, you're at ease with the situation. So remind yourself that when somebody is treating you in a bad way, remind yourself it's got nothing to do with you, it's not personal. The reason why they do this is because of something inside of them. There are certain causes and conditions that make them act in this way, right? And when you remember it's not personal, it takes away the whole problem, basically. It's not a problem anymore. And then you can sort of stand there, you can sort of feel, oh yeah, whatever, you know. And it doesn't bother you anymore. And this is the beautiful thing about it. So, you know, it's very often, a lot of this is just about perception, how you perceive the situation. A slight change in perception changes the whole problem, and it just dissolves it just like that. Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
Yeah, it seems like people are getting treated badly. If you have a compassionate response to someone, it helps you not to get swept up in the situation, so you are able to see things a lot more clearly than you would if you were angry. So it just seems to be a better short-term response to something. So not necessarily stepping away from it, but it's a better way to deal with the situation.
Yeah, you have more clarity. That's very important, because then you don't do anything stupid, yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay. This is really dragging on now. Are you ready for another short sutta, or are you?
Yeah.
You sure? Okay. This is actually a very short one. I just want to take a few minutes, so we'll see how it goes. So, okay. Actually, the last one, I didn't read the concluding line, which is, I'll just read that one as well. These, friends, are the five ways of removing resentment, by means of which a bhikkhu can entirely remove resentment towards whomever it has arisen. I think whomever here is an important word. It's everybody is included here. Okay, the next one here is called union, is the name of this particular sutta. And this sutta is essentially about how to this is a very monastic sutta, because it's basically about how to overcome attraction to the opposite gender. But it's a very interesting one, because it's a very different way of looking at this than what I have seen before. And for that reason, Sutta caught my eye when I read this one the first time. So, bhikkhus, I will teach you a Dhamma exposition on union and disengagement. Listen and attend closely. I will speak. Yes, Bhante, those bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this. And what is that Dhamma exposition on union and disengagement? A woman, bhikkhus, attends internally to her feminine faculty, her feminine comportment, her feminine appearance, her feminine aspect, her feminine desire, her feminine voice, her feminine ornamentation. She becomes excited by these and takes delight in them. excited by them, taking delight in them. She attends externally to a man's masculine faculty, his masculine comportment, his masculine appearance, his masculine aspect, his masculine desire, his masculine voice, his masculine ornamentation. She becomes excited by these and takes delight in them. Excited by them, taking delight in them, she desires union externally, and she also desires the pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are delighted with their femininity enter upon union with men. It is in this way that a woman does not transcend her femininity. A man, bhikkhus, attends internally to his masculine faculty, his masculine comportment, his masculine appearance, his masculine aspect, his masculine desire, his masculine voice, his masculine ornamentation. He becomes excited by these and takes delight in them. Excited by them, taking delight in them, he attends externally to a woman's feminine faculty, her feminine comportment, her feminine appearance, her feminine aspect, her feminine desire, her feminine voice, her feminine ornamentation. He becomes excited by these and takes delight in them. Excited by them, taking delight in them, he desires union externally, and he also desires the pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are delighted with their masculinity enter upon union with women. It is in this way that a man does not transcend his masculinity. So, the point here, as you can see, is that the reason why, the foundational reason why you get attracted to the opposite gender is not because of how you look at the opposite gender. The foundational reason, according to the sutta, is how you look at yourself. So if you identify with your own gender, if you think of yourself as a man, in whatever way that is, whether it's just the way you walk or the way you speak or whatever way it is, if you identify with those masculine aspects, masculine traits, that is when you get attracted externally to the opposite gender. It's very powerful. It's a very, very, very powerful statement. And it means that you can actually reflect for yourself. Well, do you actually delight in your own gender? Do you identify in your own gender or not? And if you do, that is where the problem starts already. It starts at that particular point. So I don't know. When I read this, I thought, wow, this is really good stuff. And this is very, very useful, particularly if you're going to live a celibate life. This sort of thing is very, very good advice indeed. And of course, then you get the opposite. So I'll read out the opposite as well, because that is actually the end of the sutta. And the Buddha says, this is how union comes about. And how does disengagement come about? A woman, bhikkhus, does not attend internally to her feminine faculty, to her feminine comportment, to her feminine appearance, her feminine aspect, her feminine desire, her feminine voice, her feminine ornamentation. She does not become excited by these or take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them, she does not attend externally to a man's masculine faculty, his masculine appearance, his masculine comportment, his masculine aspect, his masculine desire, his masculine voice, his masculine ornamentation. She does not become excited by these or take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them, she does not desire union externally, nor does she desire the pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are not delighted with their femininity become disengaged from men. It is this way that a woman transcends her femininity. A man, bhikkhus, does not attend internally to his masculine faculty, to his masculine comportment, his masculine appearance, his masculine aspect, his masculine desire, his masculine voice, his masculine ornamentation. He does not become excited by these or take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them, he does not attend externally to a woman's feminine faculty, her feminine comportment, her feminine appearance, her feminine aspect, her feminine desire, her feminine voice, her feminine ornamentation. He does not become excited by these or take delight in them. Not excited by them, not taking delight in them, he does not desire union externally, nor does he desire the pleasure and joy that arise on account of such union. Beings who are not delighted by their masculinity become disengaged from women. It is in this way that a man transcends his masculinity. This is how disengagement comes about. This, speakers, is the Dhamma exposition on union and disengagement. So, this is also in the Anguttara Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya 7, number 51. 7th, yeah. The seven aspects here that are actually mentioned. So, and those notions of gender have all to do with the five senses, the five sense world. And that's why once you transcend the five sense world, we enter into the samadhi state. So you actually go beyond gender. There's no gender anymore.
That's right. You it's conditioned and it's contextual. Buddhist cosmology, it doesn't apply everywhere. It doesn't apply every state of rebirth. Mm. And it can change from the life to life.
Yeah.
So you can, if you're someone like Venerable Ananda, you probably, you get reborn as women and eunuchs and things like that in past lives.
Yeah.
And so there's kind of less identification with gender.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Yes. It can do. It depends. I think the point here is that the more you identify with your gender, the more kind of attraction you're going to have to the opposite gender. So the more you're kind of building up that desire, if you like, there. And the less you do, the less you just think of yourself as a person, without any kind of, then the less that's going to be the case. Which is always useful, because, any kind of desire in that area is always going to be a hindrance on the path, for meditation or whatever. So it always is a useful thing, yeah. But, it is certainly very important in monastic life, because, you have to live like that, basically. You have to live a celibate life. So,
one thing is that whatever kind of life it is, any kind of desire, there has to be a restraint around it, a moderation around it. If not, then it becomes an addiction.
Yeah.
And it takes over your life and rules you rather than being part of your life that controls you rather than. So it's very important no matter what you're doing. And even if you're married, then you still need to restrain yourself regarding other people other than your partner or these kinds of things. And it's often easier for monks and nuns because we've got all the support of the veneer and the community and everything supporting us. So in the lay life, of course, there's many more temptations and opportunities. But it can be just as destructive if you're involved in sexual misconduct or something.
Monday, do you desire something more kind of primitive and more like an impulse rather than something that's conditioned? Something that we kind of learn? Like, isn't it just something that we all have and wouldn't that be denying something? Or?
It is conditioned. This is the point. It's very, very, very conditioned. And you can see that simply by, just look at the images you look at, and certain images are going to give rise to desire, some are not give rise to desire. It's a very basic kind of trick of perception. The same thing with anger. The reason why anger actually rises in the mind is because you're perceiving things in a certain way. And when you see the kind of the negative aspect of something, you can get angry or upset, or at least you get a negative reaction. So it is very, very conditioned. So it is all about perception, basically, and by changing your perceptions around, you can actually reduce the desire a lot. And again, according to the Buddha's teachings, it's possible to eliminate it completely. But that actually is a different thing, because full elimination usually happens for another reason. That happens because of insight. So it's actually a different aspect. But certainly you can reduce it a lot.
I guess sometimes I get confused with Buddhism, because sometimes it sometimes feels like a denial of something, but I guess it's something that you train yourself over time.
Yeah, it's not yeah, it's certainly not a denial. It's a natural process. It should be a natural process. I guess sometimes it may actually end up becoming a denial if you're not ready for things. But yeah. Ideally, it should be a natural process. Yeah, that's what it should be.
Yeah, to come back, relate a little bit to something we were talking about karma beforehand. According to a Buddhist cosmology, and we have a certain karma. There's a certain reason why we get born in this realm. Mm. Yeah, so we've got born in this realm, which is called the sense sphere, because of that. That mind state in past lives that sort of brought us here. If we had other states of mind, if we, for example, if we developed jhanas or did meditation, then we'd be reborn in the Brahma realm. And it would be the natural state if you cannot have those desires. And so for us, the natural state is to have them. But that's only a conditioned natural state. It's not intrinsic to who we are. And in the past, we've been in many lives where we haven't had those feelings, and in the future, we will do it again. So it's not intrinsic to who we are or to existence, but it is, it's kind of characteristic of this kind of life. But like that distinction we were making earlier between the general karma, which is meant that we're born in this realm where there's a predisposition to behaving that way, but there's also what we do from moment to moment, which is a choice about how we're going to act. And so that's not something which is conditioned by the past or conditioned by who we are, and anything that's our choice.
And that's the more sort of bigger scale, the bigger picture.
The overall thing is we've been born in the sense sphere of around it. Yeah, so that's what this life is. And but our choice at any one moment, we can choose to how we respond to that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The thing about Buddhism is that there isn't really any natural state anywhere. Everything is just conditioned. So any kind of, anything you think, anything you do, anything you perceive or whatever, it's just a matter of cause and effect, really. There is no natural state, ultimately. Just moving around.
Yeah. I think in the the hormonal changes in the body that gives rise to cravings, and things that as we practice, then it becomes stressful. We feel that there are certain things arising that are beyond our control. Basically, it's beyond volition, and we know that it's just connected with the physical form, which, through the evolutionary process, is how it came about.
Yeah, but even that is a changeable thing, It depends on your mental development as well. So it depends, these things interact with each other. Surely the physical body, true, it has some effect on the mind, and the mind has effect on the body, and they interact with each other. But it's not a state which is like, fixed or anything like that. It changes and it moves. And you might even be able to overcome that state entirely by your mental practice. This is the promise of deep meditation, that regardless of your physical state, your physical body, you can leave the body completely behind, and all you have left is a mental state. In that case, it doesn't matter anymore what the body does. The body can do whatever it wants. You have gone beyond that. And certainly, when you take into account the idea of rebirth, that you may go in a completely different realm in the future life, then you can certainly see that this is very conditioned, and that there is no kind of there's nothing there which really goes across, so to speak, and there's no permanence in this thing, and there's just cause and conditions and cause and effect arising and passing away.
Okay, so for people, is there an alternative, a healthy way to be attracted to someone without being too attached to your own identity?
Yeah.
Not
so
identity, but...
Yeah. I think in the end, from a Buddhist point of view, there's obviously bad ways of doing it, like we talked about before, in like breaking the precepts and that sort of thing. Yeah. That's obviously the bad way of having relationships or whatever, or not having them or whatever you want to call it. But from a higher kind of Buddhist view, anything which has to do with sensual desire is a defilement. And it's going to block you in terms of meditation practice. So, in the very kind of high sense, and I'm talking about very high sense of the word now, it is something you want to overcome. But for all practical purposes, You know, if you live a good life, and the Buddha always, there are people in the suttas who are very, very highly developed spiritually, and yet they lived a married life. You know, they had relationships and things like that, and yet they were very highly developed. So you can take it to a very high level, but in the ultimate sense, you have to sort of let go of it. But it's sometimes it's best not to focus too much on the ultimate and the highest sense, because sometimes it is just too, it becomes just like a, it's this kind of mirage. I mean, you don't know what it is basically. It's just, yeah, in many ways, it's nice to know it's there, but it's very kind of lofty, lofty things. Yeah.
Yes, that's something that would be easy to suppress. I mean, not easy. The people try to suppress that part, like they say, okay, I'll always identify with my feminine side, and then ultimately, internally, to actually achieve that, I'm sorry, I'm not being rather incoherent, but in the sutta, you need to sort of transcend all of these things. Being identifying, not, transcend sort of identification with agenda. That's easier said than done.
Yeah. No, of course it is.
It might be easy to think that you've done that. And in doing so,
I think like with so many parts, so much of the path, it's a gradual thing. You know, it's something you do gradually, and you start off with the course is kind of manifestations of that. And sometimes you just find yourself doing things sort of delighting, and you sort of walk in a certain way, and you think, oh, I'm delighting being a man or whatever. You think this is a kind of manly way of walking or whatever. And then you find yourself actually very deliberately delighting in this particular thing. Yeah? Or you start, you may start exercising and pushing weights and sort of delighting and building up your muscles or something like that. That's a kind of male thing to do. And if you do that, that should sort of ring a few bells. You know, particularly if you're monastic, it can be very dangerous. And I've seen these things happening, and it can be very destructive. If you start off with the coarser aspects, the very obvious ones, and then you take it from there, I think that's probably, like everything else, that's probably the way to go.
I'm not sure whether it's actually really a specific interpretation of it. A lot of the times the masters hold that they should behave like a man. And I was just wondering whether similar thing is in the Pali version, or that kind of idea either in the Vinaya or something.
I can't remember ever seeing anything like that, but I also not. It's far more expert in that. And that'd be cool to be another than I am.
Did they ever say that men should behave like men should behave?
It's probably not said it for any time, but we take out the monastic life. We are supposed to be like da zang fu, meaning we have that courage to take out the difficult tasks of disciplining and all those things. So it's like da means big, zang fu, how much in zang fu, zang fu.
It's like
a real master. Although it's not a physical kind of thing, but the traits of the behavior and conduct and the way you think and all that is like being transformed instead of being a feminine, salty. You become somebody who has strength and courage and discipline. So this is the thing that is being referred to as
Sa-Sang-Fu.
Not to become that girl's first thing,
strawberry, you just get squashed in the woods. Strawberries get squashed very easily. Yeah, when you are full of strawberries, you are a real failure.
But that's what women guys aren't emotional, which, I mean, it's the truth is they hide so much. So, I mean, in a way, that's sort of, that's a preconception. You know, men and women are equal in a sense, it's just that guys tend not to show their feelings. So, I mean, that's quite, I find that interesting how they're told to actually be, you know, like men in that sense, because it comes down to an individual person, like, you know, if it's easy for them or how they... You know, can do that or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting point. I find it interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Actually, what I was going to ask is that in order for one to disassociate from identifying with the gender, does one need at least to be a stream enterer?
I think, you know, for the full dissociation, for sure, you probably had to be anagami even to, for full dissociation. But the point is that, you know, it happens already in samadhi. This is the point, you know. And this is the interesting thing, you know, you can, if you have a good samadhi, already gradually disengaging from this whole thing here. And, you know, talking about being a wuss is interesting because, of course, the wuss, wuss, strawberry. So, it's another word, yeah. Because one of the classical ways of entering kind of, you know, the samadhi and the jhana realms is through metta, you know. Metta is one of the ways of doing that, yeah. So that is kind of the kind, you know, it has a very, you know, if anything has a kind of feminine aspect to it, it would be, you know, maybe metta and compassion. Yeah. Of course, it doesn't have that because it actually transcends, you know, femininity and masculinity, yeah. So it's, you know, you can be soft, but it's like soft in the right way, you know, it's a kind of, yeah.
So what it's really saying is that the transcendence is genderless. So it's not
about
identification with either gender.
Precisely, that's the whole point.
So
that's the whole point. Yeah.
So becoming masculine is totally unproductive.
Yeah.
For a man becoming very feminine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But isn't it about not forcing anything? You know, just having, you know, because if you force it, then it's just feels wrong.
Yeah, it's not about forcing it, but it's, but yeah. But it's about having awareness, you know. And this is the nice thing about this kind of suttas. It makes you aware that something is happening. You may never have thought about it before, yeah. And suddenly it makes you aware, that, wait a minute, what am I doing with myself? How am I thinking? How am I relating to myself? And you realize that maybe some of the ways of relating with yourself actually is not helpful for this kind of practice.
So is it like letting nature take its course, but within reason and being logical, well, not logically, but being aware of what you're doing at the same time? Is it?
Well, it's not really allowing nature to take its course, because nature has many kind of, you know, bad sides to it. I mean, nature can be like getting angry, for example, right? You can say that, oh, I'm feeling angry now, so I'm just going to let it take its course. So that's not the Buddhist way either. Yeah. The Buddhist way is to try to, on the one hand, try not to allow nature to take its course, on the one hand. On the other hand, try to avoid suppressing things in the way which it becomes psychologically problematic. Yeah. So you avoid it in a skillful way. That's really the best way of looking at the Buddhist way. Yeah.
Because don't let that let out your emotions. Because I mean, in the long term, suppressing it is just, you know, not good.
I think I suspect that kind of psychological thing that we're supposed to let it out is just to sort of counteract this idea of suppressing it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you want to avoid suppressing, so let it out. But I mean, it doesn't have to be either one. There can be a middle way there. You find yourself getting angry, okay, you look at the situation differently, or you walk away, or you do something else. You don't have to either suppress or whatever.
Angry, I must admit, you know, everything's so distorted.
You have to catch it very early on, that's the thing, yeah.
So I guess the only way to actually think like that is to let your anger out. So, I don't know, I guess it's
just a gradual process. Like, I mean, sometimes maybe in the beginning.
But the first step would be you have to let that anger out so you can minimize that distortion and see more clearly.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you can't do anything when you're angry, the truth is. You
but know. Then over time, because you've developed the techniques and stuff, it's easier to manage it without suppressing it.
So it's a time thing. You just sort of. You can't just go from, you know, like, oh, I'm angry, oh, but, you know, you can't do it logically.
The idea of letting your anger out and trying to, the psychological studies have shown that it just doesn't work.
It's human nature, isn't it?
It's human nature to do it, but it actually reinforces the behavior. It doesn't improve.
Yes.
So the goodest way of doing it is to start with mindfulness. You recognize what's happening.
Okay.
And if you do let it out, then you're mindful of that as well. Especially, I'm mindful, I'm yelling at somebody. But the difference with suppression is that suppression is pretending that it's not there.
Right.
So that's different from restraint. Restraint is, you know it's there, but you don't act it out.
Okay.
Yeah, because acting it out doesn't just reinforces it.
Mm.
It validates it. Yeah. Mm. So you recognise it, but suppressing is like, I'm not angry. You know, who's angry?
Right.
You're not you. You're not angry. You for sure.
That's denial.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. But also, when you're angry, and I've been very angry, when you're angry, and if you can, instead of just going for it, if you can catch yourself and kind of go a little bit into love and communication, like say, I feel this because you're doing that, you know, it's like you just sort of maybe talk it through instead of pushing and forcing yourself just to have a more adult, because anger is almost like this. It doesn't have any effect. Anger, you don't get respect or people don't listen to you when you're angry.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's almost like it's better to kind of just get a little bit, go a little deeper and say, why, you know, tell them, what is it underneath the anger? It's never about the anger. It's something deeper. It's about a hurt. And if you can get to that place of kind of just being able to communicate your true feelings rather than just, because anger is always about blame. It's always like, isn't it really, kind of? You did that. But anyway, if you can point it back to yourself and take it back and see it instead of jumping on.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it's talking about getting a bit of insight into how your anger works, and if you can use that in a wise way, it's great. Yeah.
Sounds, but it's practical again, yeah. Sometimes we just get angry and that's good.
yeah, and it's fine. You know, sometimes it's okay. You just don't get upset with yourself for getting angry. That makes the matter worse, you know. So
Does Buddhism assume, or does it ultimately mean that once people can overcome those hindrances, they can achieve this universal state of mind? Is it, or does it vary from person to person? As in,
essentially, it is the same for all people because people are the same. According to Buddhist teaching, people are exactly the same. You know, people are kind of a what they call it five khandhas in Buddhism, the five aggregates, the five kind of groupings. And, so essentially people are all the same. So because they're all the same, if you follow the certain path, you reach the same state. So if you overcome the hindrances, it means that you are, you know, the mental state of somebody as two different people both overcome the five hindrances, is going to be pretty much the same. Because that's just the principle, like it's like, almost like a universal principle.
Because, I mean, if you look at one hindrance, you know, the degree of hindrance for one person would be different to, say, another person who's had, like, a wonderful life and everything's been easy for them.
Sure, yeah. That's exactly right, yeah. So some people have much more to deal with than other people.
Yeah.
But the full overcoming is still the same. It's roughly the same thing, yeah. And you find that these particular states of mind that you can reach when you overcome these things, they are described in a very kind of specific way in the Buddhist discourse, in the suttas. They have a very kind of specific characteristics. These characteristics are going to be the same regardless of who you are.
That teaching, it seems to be a lot about attachment, not only to your own identity, but to another person. But is it okay if you love someone without being attached to them? If you know what I mean? Like, love them wholeheartedly, but not...
Yeah.
Be with them for the wrong reason.
It's very hard to love like an individual person without being attached. That's not normally goes together. Yeah. Without needing them. It's good. I mean, the more you can do that, the better. Yeah. But generally speaking, if you actually are, you know, if it's a kind of ordinary relationship with somebody, usually there is bound to be some attachment there. It's very hard to avoid attachment altogether. Yeah. The kind of love that you have in Buddhism, which is called metta, is not related to individual people, is related to, you know, everybody, basically. It's not kind of focused on a particular person. If it is focused on a particular person, it usually means that there is some attachment there. So ideally what you have is you have this kind of universal mind state whereby you have the same, roughly the similar feelings for everybody, basically. and you know, no anger towards anybody. Yeah.
I think one of the most useful things to attract to another person is their virtue and their wisdom. Those sort of qualities.
Mm-hmm.
They're very universal, it's not male or feminine. It's, seems the most useful thing to be attached to or attracted to.
Mm. So you mean if you're going to be attracted to somebody, be attracted to their virtue and their wisdom,
yeah.
Rather than anything else?
Right, yeah.
It's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess it's more realizing that if it's their qualities that you're attracted to, you know, it's not really a physical thing. You don't actually need to be attached to a person. Because that universal thing, whether they're near a flower or wherever they are in the world, it'll stay with you.
Yeah.
So hence you don't really need that sense of attachment, have that person in front of your face 24/7 sort of thing.
So very few people get to that.
But I guess when over time when you're in a relationship and stuff, I guess that's what it comes down to. That's what you find, the inner layers of the person. Yeah. Really, what's all that?
Okay, so we call it a day, I think. Okay. Yeah.
Bhagavato Sāmi.